ever since the world ended. I don't go out as much. People that I once befriended just don't bother to stay in touch. Things that used to seem so splendid don't really matter today. It's just as well the world ended. It wasn't working anyway. Ever since the world
ended. Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today. Every week I end this show by reminding us all to keep making history. And I don't think there's been a week, at least not in my lifetime, when that's been more true. A global pandemic hasn't happened since 1918, and during the 2008 economic meltdown, we didn't see the kind of mass shutdowns we're seeing across the country and around the world today. The 9/11 attacks primarily affected the United States, and life returned to our streets relatively quickly, unlike the current crisis, which is global and, so far, has no end in sight. So for this week's show, we have two reports ripped from today's headlines as we make our way through these historic times, with our focus, as always, on the effects on working people.
Well, we have to work, even if it's forced overtime. People need to eat, and I need to pay the bills. I'm just telling myself today and yesterday and probably tomorrow, it'll get better. And I'm happy to help out in my way.
Those are the words of a St. Louis supermarket worker, read by People's World reporter Al Neal, from his report last Thursday featuring interviews with workers in the service, health, and other sectors who are still going to their jobs each day during the coronavirus crisis, the ones keeping our society functioning.
Working class culture and workers' movements have long carried within their DNA the antidote to what now threatens us. The COVID-19 pandemic reminds us of the timeless truth of the principle once popularized by the noble and holy order of the Knights of Labor, the largest workers' organization in 19th century America, who taught an injury to one must be the concern of all.
That's labor historian Joe McCartan reading from his post this week on the Working Class Perspectives blog. Also this week, we mark the anniversary of the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, still among the most deadly in our nation's history. Here's the show. Last Thursday, People's World, which is the latest iteration of the Daily Worker, founded back in 1924, published an evocative piece entitled Silent Streets, Life Halts, But Not for All Workers, written by reporter Al Neal. The first installment of a two-part series featured interviews with workers in the service, health, and other sectors who are still going to their jobs each day during the coronavirus crisis, the ones keeping our society functioning. Al talked to workers in St. Louis, but they could have been anywhere in the world. Their voices seldom heard and worth listening to. Here's Al.
The mood is uneasy. The streets are quiet and show their pain through the paint-chipped curbs, cracked sidewalks, and boarded alleyway doors. There's no foot traffic. Crowds no longer gather to hide the city's worn-down facade. Off in the distance, church bells rings. No one is listening, and soon it will be overtaken by the sounds of emergency vehicle sirens dashing off to care for troubled souls during troubled times. This is a new reality. It's the reality of a life lived from a distance, at least 6 to 12 feet apart. With the rapid spread of the COVID-19 coronavirus, and in the wake of a bumbling and short-sighted response from Washington, D.C., communities have finally begun self-isolating at the request of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Stay home, read a book, walk outside with precaution, and be patient. Those are the instructions, more or less. But not everyone can do that. For those individuals working in the service sectors, some things have to keep going. Public transportation to and from work will be needed. Customers' scant tips will be a necessity to weather this financial hellstorm. Shoppers' items have to be handled, scanned, and bagged. Health emergencies have to be addressed, even when personal protective equipment is in short supply. And on and on and on. Their reality is this. If we can't work, we can't feed or care for our own families. It goes beyond just the need for bread and butter. For many of these workers, they are the front line in the fight against the greatest health crisis of our time. It is something they know and take pride in. A laughing child breaks a silent walk down city streets. A family of four have left their home for a quick morning walk, taking full advantage of the street's emptiness. Anxiety and fear accompany the spread of a viral pandemic, leading many to prepare for the worst possible scenario. Crisis leads to a disorderly but methodical response. Stock up on basic supplies and hunker down. So it was no surprise to find the grocery store parking lot packed full. Adults were pushing shopping carts overflowing with canned goods, toilet paper, boxes of dry pasta, and hand sanitizer, while simultaneously dragging their kids behind them. No one leisurely walks up and down the aisles, eyeing for the preferred brand. Instead, they all seem to be on a mission to get in and get out. Several shoppers sport the now common white surgical mask and blue non-latex gloves. Eye contact is avoided. No small talk takes place. Towards the paper and sanitary product aisle, you see many unhappy faces, many cell phones pulled out of pockets to inform whoever's on the other end of the line, they're out of toilet paper here too, damn it. The entire rack has been cleared, and no one can confirm when the shelf will be restocked. Standing in the checkout line behind a grocery worker who's off shift finally with her cart full, I notice the exhaustion in the eyes of all the clerks. When did you get in today? One shouts across the lane to another. Clocked in at 6:30 this morning. The other replies, looking down at his watch, still waiting for my first break. It was now 2 p.m. As I made my way to the register, I met Nicole. She was working a double shift and mentioned to her manager she needed to get off the line to call and cancel her son's breathing treatment. I don't know if you can tell from my eyes, she said while scanning my bag of coffee, but I'm exhausted. I asked her how things had been going at work since the government announcement pushing stay home with 2 weeks worth of food. Oh, it's been crazy, she said. Today's been a bit better than yesterday, but people have been in here constantly, and they're not always the nicest. They're in such a rush they forget we're only human, too. What do you mean, I ask. Well, they come in, fill up an entire cart with bottled water, and expect us to unload it, scan it, and then load it back up for them without any help. Nicole looks to be in her mid to late 30s, and is all of 5 feet tall. She continued, I already have a bad back from working in the warehouse, and this is just going to make it worse. I can't even get a thank you from customers most days. But we have to work, even if it's forced overtime. People need to eat, and I need to pay the bills. I'm just telling myself today and yesterday and probably tomorrow it'll get better, and I'm happy to help out in my way. Working in the industry as professionals in the food and restaurant business call it comes with a few perks. Late nights with cash in hand, close friendships with other industry workers, and intimate knowledge of the best places to check out. Knowledge only shared with friends, family, and good tippers. Kate has worked as a bartender in an upscale sushi restaurant for 3 years. She's been at the restaurant for 5, working up from slinging plates to slinging drinks. We spoke briefly during her lunch break. As more and more eateries and businesses closed to help stop the spread of coronavirus, she couldn't understand why corporate hadn't closed down her store. They sent out an email to the customers letting them know about the precautions they were taking to make dining a safe experience, she said. But they didn't say anything to us about it or what steps they would take to keep us healthy. Kate, 28, is immunocompromised and suffers from a genetic disease. I don't mind coming into work a shift. I take care of myself, wash my hands, and avoid touching my face. Hopefully, I'll be okay, she said. It's just the people who come in to get a drink that I'm worried about. They're coming into contact with me, and I have no idea where they've been or if they could have been exposed. She was scheduled to work an evening shift after her replacement called in sick. What pisses me off is that we've been so slow, she continued. At this point, corporate is making zero money off of staying open. Yet, here we all are. She laughed before saying, and the few people that come in complain that I don't stay behind the bar the entire time they're drinking. I was honest and told them, I am following CDC guidelines and staying at least 12 feet away from you. Their reactions were stunned to silence. something she'd expected but was okay with. If we have to stay open, I'll make sure those of us here stay safe until the city or state or whoever says we need to close. As her lunch break came to an end, I asked Kate about how the pandemic had affected her personally, if she'd learned anything from what's happening. Well, for one, to make sure I brew coffee the night before. I don't want to put any of my barista friends at risk, she said. Also, I've never really been a political person, but with how things have been playing out, I've realized corporate and politicians don't give a shit about those of us at the bottom. We deserve full pay and benefits during this crisis time, and I'll vote whoever I have to out of office to make sure we're not left behind ever again. Seeds of radicalism planted by a crisis. A small silver lining as society reflects upon how we treat one another.
That was reporter Al Neal reading his piece, Silent Streets, Life Halts, But Not For All Workers. You'll find it and the second installment at peoplesworld.org. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, its effects extend far beyond our health or even the anxiety and disruption of efforts to slow transmission and flatten the curve. John Russo, co-editor of the Working Class Perspectives blog, points out that among those most hurt by this pandemic are workers, from healthcare workers whose jobs make social distancing impossible to the mostly low-wage service workers whose hours are being cut as restaurants, bars, and stores are shutting down. Yet, as labor historian Joe McCartan wrote in Working Class Perspectives this week, crises like this present challenges but also potential opportunities. As Joe reminds us, working class culture and workers' movements have long carried within their DNA the antidote to what now threatens us. Here's Joe.
COVID-19, the coronavirus that is spreading across the world, is wreaking havoc on working people and their families. Weeks after it burst on the world scene, the end of this deadly threat is still not in sight. Although it is clear that its death toll will not begin to approximate that of the lethal 1918-19 worldwide Spanish influenza epidemic, early indications are that COVID-19 could end up inflicting even more economic and political damage than that earlier pandemic. Its impact is likely to reveal with deeper clarity than we have seen in a long time the class lines that divide our society and the true costs of decades of deepening inequality. There is no escaping the class dimensions of the COVID-19 outbreak. For working people are most likely to be affected by both the virus and efforts to contain its spread. The way they earn their livings necessarily exposes many workers to the risk of contracting the disease. Some, such as nurses and home care workers, put themselves at risk on the front lines caring for those who are ill. More than a third of the 180 workers at Life Care Center in Kirkland, Washington, the Seattle area nursing home where 13 patients died of COVID-19, appear to have contracted the virus. Other workers, including flight attendants, teachers, and food service workers, have worked in highly interactive settings where the virus could easily be contracted and transmitted. If they do contract the virus, working class people are more likely to die from it because they disproportionately experience one of the underlying medical conditions that makes COVID-19 much deadlier than the flu, heart disease, diabetes, and lung disease. Moreover, if they feel ill, U.S. workers are more likely to delay seeing a doctor, either because they lack health insurance or have high copays that discourage them from getting treatment. Efforts to contain the spread of COVID-19 also have a class dimension. As the Chinese and Italians found, workplaces provide natural nodes of virus transmission. In order to restrain the spread of COVID-19, the Chinese government adopted strict quarantine measures that prevented nearly 300 million migrant workers from returning to their jobs after the Chinese New Year celebrations, shuttering that nation's manufacturing economy for 3 weeks. Italy did the same. Fiat Chrysler closed its Italian plants as the virus spread, and now U.S. auto plants are also shut down. Unite Here, the union of hotel and hospitality workers, is bracing for the layoff of as much as 90% of its membership. Manufacturing and service workers worldwide cannot telework, as many white-collar or professional workers are now beginning to do. Hourly workers are far more likely to lose income than salaried workers during the coming weeks of social distancing. So far, bills to extend federal sick leave protection cover only 20% of American workers. Among the vulnerable and least protected workers are independent contractors and gig workers. Few of them can afford to stop working. Many are now in the position where they must decide between staying home and facing personal financial ruin, or going out to work and thus accelerating the spread of a deadly pandemic. In their classic 1929 study, Middletown, Helen and Robert Lind observed that the class lines separating working class from middle class neighborhoods in 1920s Muncie, Indiana, were most visible before dawn. Working class homes were the first to switch on their lights as their occupants rose to face the workday ahead, which started much earlier than the 9 to 5 days of the business class. In the weeks ahead, the class lines that divide today's America might become most visible around those who must still venture out to work and those who can work from the safety of home. Yet crises can also be opportunities. For 40 years, Americans have been subjected to the drumbeat of libertarian market fundamentalism, the endlessly repeated allegation that government action could only worsen problems. The 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." But who's laughing at that line now? Crises like the current one have a way of exposing the bad faith of unclad emperors and their minions. If the impact of wars, depressions, and epidemics tend to be differentiated along class lines, they also have given the lie to ideologies rooted in atavistic individualism. While they demand expertise and intelligent leadership, crises of this kind cannot be resolved by dear leaders who issue dictates. Both their courses and their consequences transcend the individual. They demand mass mobilization and collective action on behalf of the common good. Although we have not chosen this moment, it is within our power to decide how to meet it. We could deepen divisions and set off on a fool's errand of building a fortress America, as our wall-obsessed president urges, by cynically labeling the contagion a Chinese virus, or we could use it as an opportunity to build community, forge solidarity, revive internationalism, and renovate the crumbling edifice of democracy. Working class culture and workers' movements have long carried within their DNA the antidote to what now threatens us. The COVID-19 pandemic reminds us of the timeless truth of the principle once popularized by the Noble and Holy Order of the Knights of Labor, the largest workers' organization in 19th century America, who taught an injury to one must be the concern of all. If we embrace that time-honored ideal, not only can we reduce the potential lethality of COVID-19, we can begin to build a world more resistant to future plagues. This is Joe McCartan.
You can find Joe's post at workingclassstudies.wordpress.com. With a COVID-19 death toll of over 10,000 so far and climbing, perhaps the death of 146 garment workers over a century ago doesn't register today as a major tragedy. But it did, and it does. Here's why.
This is Saul Schneiderman from the Labor Heritage Foundation with a Labor History Today story to tell about March 25th, 1911, which is the date of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, which would become the deadliest industrial disaster in the history of New York and one of the deadliest in U.S. history. The Triangle fire caused the death of 146 garment workers, 123 women and girls, and 23 men, most of them immigrants who died from the fire. Many of them were from Italian or Jewish heritage, and there were young girls as young as 14 and young women as young as 23 who died in that fire. This is a story about health and safety, of fire prevention and emergency procedures, because the doors in the factory and the stairwells and exits were locked. And so many of the workers who could not escape from the burning building jumped from the high windows. Yes, many New Yorkers that day were horrified to see workers jumping from the 8th and 9th floors of the Ash Building, landing on the sidewalks below. This fire led to legislation requiring improved safety standards, and it helped spur the growth of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, or the ILGWU, which in the years to come would fight for better working conditions for sweatshop workers in the United States. Now, Chris Llewellyn, a poet in Washington, D.C., wrote a book of poems on the Triangle Fire back in the 1980s, and John O'Connor, a musician, read one of those poems and was inspired to write a ballad, of which I'll now sing you a part of it. On the 8th and the 9th and the 10th floor, this factory of workers in the garment trade were stuffed into the rooms where so many were doomed at the end of the Sabbath day.
Oh, the doors were all locked and the fire escapes weak. The whole building was a trap and a peril. Just to save a few bucks for the rich run amok, who made money from the lives of young girls. Fire was the cry from the windows up high. I saw, but I could not believe. Two girls on the ledge as they jumped from the edge into the arms of eternity. Choice for a young girl of 16 or so, but the sweatshops for the shirtwaist they sell. And what choice for a soul in a 10-story hole, but the pavement or the fires of hell? Now the question still looms in the workshops and rooms. The question, I'll pose it. When you stand to defend all the capitalists and their friends, what price for the profits of few? And murder I'll cry till the day that I die, for I saw but I could not believe. Two girls on the ledge as they jump from the edge into the arms of eternity. The arms of eternity.
Ever since the world ended, there's no more Bible Belt. Remember how we all pretended, going round line by felt. Every rule has been amended. There's no one keeping score. it's just as well the world ended. We couldn't have taken much more.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app, and we hope you do. And please pass it along, too. We appreciate it. Also, if you'd like to contribute by reading a labor history item, just shoot us a note, laborhistorytoday@gmail.com. Love to hear from you. Today's music included Ever Since the World Ended by Mose Allison and The Triangle Fire by John O'Connor. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozek, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Scarlock. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and healthy, but do keep making history. And see you next time.
Ever since the world ended, there's no more black or white. Ever since we all got blended, there's no more reason to fuss and fight. Dogmas that we once defended no longer seem worthwhile. Ever since the world ended, I faced the future. Smile.